Hart had come to Bangkok with a masterful presentation for his two friends in support of a major CIA escalation. All three men knew there were two questions that had to be addressed. First, were the Mujahideen for real? Could they sustain a resistance against the Soviets? Hart said they could. They were prepared to die in fantastic numbers, and he was convinced that, if supplied, they would fight hard for many years. Second, and even more important, would the jumpy Pakistan authorities allow the war to expand? On this point, Hart felt particularly proud to report that he had succeeded in forging a powerful relationship with Zia's intelligence chief, General Akhtar Abdul Rahman, who now supported the proposed initiative. Most important, Zia himself had signed off on it. Kogan wanted to know what Hart had in mind. "I said we needed $12 million more, or some figure like that," Kogan remembers. "I just picked the number from my head. It wasn't that much in raw dollars, but it was a very big deal because it marked a significant increase in the percentage of funding, and it meant that Chuck would have to go back to the agency's senior leadership and then to the White House and Congress for a new approval." Hart didn't try to hide anything about the downside of this ferocious rabble. He knew what worried Kogan, so he anticipated the division chief's criticism by offering his clever observation about the nature of the Afghans. "They're so crooked," he said, "that when they die, you don't bury them, you just screw them into the ground." But then I explained that they probably would not rip us off any more than the American army would in a wartime situation. I said that the Mujahideen might never be organized the way we would like, but there was a spirit and a commitment to a cause that lived in them now and might not be around in a little while if it did not get them more support. "Carpe diem," Hart said after finishing his initial pitch. "Seize the day." It was the kind of flourish, perhaps, that only those who had gone to certain prep schools could get away with in such an encounter. The ball was now in Kogan's court, and Hart was sympathetic to his division chief's caution. It was risky business in 1982 for a CIA man to propose a large-scale covert operation. The agency had basically been out of that business for years, ever since the accumulated impact of the congressional investigations, the press exposés, the Halloween Day massacre, and Jimmy Carter. Only 2 years earlier, when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, Hart says, the agency had nothing going against the communists, except perhaps a few insignificant undertakings like smuggling Korans over the Soviet border. He can recall vividly everyone's caution when the agency was called upon to write the first Afghan finding for the president to sign. He was then the desk officer for Afghanistan, and no one could even remember what a finding was supposed to look like or what the language was supposed to be. So they had gone to the files and dug one up. Kogan and he talked and reached the conclusion that they didn't dare call for anything radical right away. They proposed something like $700,000, much of it for communications equipment. But now Hart was asking the same division chief to sign off on millions to kill Soviet soldiers. Hart says he was fully prepared to return empty-handed from Bangkok, and had anyone else made the recommendation, Kogan might have held back. But the clandestine services are built on trust. "You're the guy on the ground," McGaffin had told Hart when he went to Pakistan. "This is your war out there. Just tell us what you need." In this same spirit, Kogan decided to run with his station chief. Together, the three composed a cable to headquarters. "We spelled out what we wanted and why, and Chuck signed it. That was the beginning of the big time," he said. If Howard Hart had explained any of this to Wilson, perhaps the congressman would have been more sympathetic. But Hart kept these stories within the family. It was hard to keep his mouth shut, however, when the congressman pressed to know what the United States was doing to stop the Red Army from sending its gunships to slaughter the freedom fighters. Hart found himself having to explain the basics, how, as a matter of long-standing Cold War policy, the CIA didn't use American weapons that would reveal the country's hand. It was critical to maintain the fiction that the Afghans had captured their weapons in battles with the Soviets. Hart wanted to help as much as Wilson, but surely the congressman would understand that it would be foolish to provoke the Soviets into a major retaliation against Pakistan. These perfectly sensible arguments fell on deaf ears. Hart was a master at maintaining a poker face, but this congressman was driving him crazy. Of course, it was easy for Wilson, in his dream world, to come in shooting his mouth off about pumping up the program to the bursting point with untold millions, but Hart had to live in the real world. It galled Hart to realize that Wilson didn't even understand that the U.S. Embassy had been torched by a mob of Muslim radicals who hated America and had been quite ready to kill as many as they could find. That's why he was in this shithole of a station chief's office. Hart not only had to operate from cramped quarters, but he had to be ready to destroy all his files in 7 minutes, the time he figured he would have if the KGB ever decided to rouse the ever-ready Islamic mob. And at the heart of it all, something he could never explain to Wilson, lay his triumph in having won over General Akhtar, the stern and secretive intelligence chief. Hart and Akhtar had met at least once or twice a week at the general's offices, the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate headquarters in Islamabad. The general always dressed in uniform, and tea was served. By the time Wilson swooped in, Akhtar and Hart had all but fallen in love professionally. Part of the secret of Hart's success was the way, on every public occasion, he always deferred to the great General Akhtar, who took to affectionately calling him H2 because of the two H's in his name. Akhtar's affection for Hart was so enormous that when the next station chief took up his post, the general insisted on calling him H2, much to the CIA man's annoyance. The friendship was genuine, but it was also the product of a highly disciplined operational effort. As Hart saw it, his relationship with Akhtar was the best way the United States could effectively influence the one man who truly counted. "I would meet with Akhtar and talk strategy," he explained. "Then Akhtar would go to Zia, and Zia would approve every single item, every single incremental escalation." Hart had gone to great trouble to establish his place in this process, so he found it aggravating to hear Wilson hinting that the Pakistanis were eager to fight a bigger war. What a laugh! Hart had sat in when the enthusiastic new CIA director, William Casey, had met with Zia in Rawalpindi to offer more assistance. "What can we give you? How much do the Afghans need?" Every time anyone asked that question, Zia always responded with the same speech. "Ah, Mr. Casey, we must make the pot boil for the Russians, but not so much that it boils over onto Pakistan." Zia had given his little pot-boiling story so many times that Hart and Akhtar rolled their eyes at each other whenever he began. But that was the crux of the matter. How far was Zia willing to go? "No one knew the answer," recalls Hart, "so one of my jobs was to figure this out. You must understand that at the time even Zia did not know the limits." The station chief had no way of knowing that Wilson was then in the process of forging a direct relationship with Zia. Soon this link would end the convoluted process that Hart had so carefully erected to service his country's goals. Back then, however, Hart could not imagine the Pakistanis taking Wilson seriously. He saw only a dangerously energetic meddler. The only overt tension that surfaced between the two men came when Wilson implied that Hart and the CIA were not doing enough to shoot down the Hind helicopters. Hart surprised Wilson when he argued that the weapons the CIA was already providing the Afghans, 12.7mm DSHK machine guns, were all that the Mujahideen needed. Guns, including anti-aircraft guns, had been the congressman's specialty when he had been in the Navy, and he thought that Hart's belief in the DSHK was absurd. The Afghans didn't believe machine guns were the answer, and he knew that the Soviets had armor-plated their Hind helicopters specifically to resist a 12.7mm shell. The congressman poured on the charm as he probed, trying to enlist the CIA man in his campaign. "Don't you need more weapons?" he asked again. What was Hart supposed to say to a question like that, particularly when it was being asked again and again in different ways? Finally, he explained, "If what you are asking is, do I have as many weapons as there are Afghans who would like to be armed, the answer is no, but we're doing very well." The station chief had been very careful in making this final point, but Wilson heard something quite different than perhaps was intended. He heard Howard Hart sending a distress signal. He thought he could understand the code. Hart was asking for help. The CIA man was now in that insecure position that bureaucrats so often find themselves when single-minded politicians burst into their lives. He could feel that Wilson was trying to grab the helm, but these were dangerous waters. The last thing Hart wanted was for this energetic amateur to screw things up by offering his noisy assistance. He and McGaffin and Cogan and Akhtar were doing just fine. In fact, they were doing brilliantly. What Wilson could do would be to go away and not come back. But as the two men said goodbye in Islamabad that day in November 1982, Howard Hart had the uneasy feeling that it was not the last time he would see this congressman from Texas.